Hi there, this is the takeaway for Thursday, May 4th, 2017.
Hello, can I help you find something?
I'm John Hockenberry, and I don't know if you can help me.
And I'm Queen of Kim, along for the ride today. But John, you might not have a choice in America's future labor force.
But at least I'm not a robot. This is the takeaway from KQED in San Francisco.
And this hour, how automation is rapidly changing our workplaces.
It's not that all jobs are going to go away. It's just the character of jobs is going to be radically different.
Also, could a guaranteed basic income here in the United States substitute for some of the things we get from work?
Like how, for most of us, work is way more than just a paycheck.
About 3/4 of Americans say they would continue to work even if they had enough money to financially support themselves for the rest of their life. People get a lot more than just money from work.
You have workforce stories, so do we this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. You know, I say that every single day on this program. How robotic does that sound?
Well, you're getting there, the robot sound. I'm Queenie Kim, senior editor of KQED's Silicon Valley Desk. And you know, John, we're lucky that our jobs require our minds and that they're pretty stable.
Now, I'm repeating myself, but would we call this journalism job, this radio hosting job, a high skill?
Well, I don't think it depends on what we think. I think what I've learned during this hour of preparing for the show is that it's the market that decides what jobs stay and what jobs go, and they'll decide whether we actually have skills.
Yikes. Which is why we are in San Francisco at KQED. We are looking at the rapid changing workplace this hour from Silicon Valley just down the bay, where there is so much innovation that's changing the present and shaping the future, to the more traditional workplaces in this very diverse West Coast urban center. Fortunately, no robots in those traditional workplaces like our radio studio, right?
Hello. Can I help you find something?
John, meet the Lobot.
Tell me by pressing the speak button or typing below.
The Lobot, right, and through the magic of radio, we're whisked to the floor of the big box Lowe's Home Improvement Center in East San Jose. Lobot is a white plastic pillar thing on wheels. It talks, it's got a screen, and it's not really that intimidating. Is that the intention?
I'm Kyle Nell, and I'm the executive director of the Lowe's Innovation Labs.
He's not a robot. And he's also the
Vice President of Disruptive Innovation.
Nell's been developing the Lobot, trying to match technology that's already available, GPS and the like, with advanced software that hopefully matches what consumers want, that won't creep them out, that will help customers navigate their way around this massive store.
Technology is increasing at an exponential rate, and meanwhile, our customers are walking around with these supercomputers in their pockets. Their expectations are growing day by day, and our ability to service that need is not as fast as that. So how do we give people what they really want in an intuitive way without just like overwhelming them, dumping stuff on them, and making more of a holistic experience? And that's actually a really hard thing to do.
So how'd they come up with the Lobot?
We actually give all of our marketing research and trend data to professional published science fiction writers. And then, because they're uniquely capable of kind of sifting through all of the possible, probable kind of permutations of the future, and then coming up with how that will actually play out. So it's not like virtual reality will be a big deal, or robotics will be a big deal. It's like how those things might play out together. So like think Back to the Future Part 2. And then we literally make real short stories with characters, conflict, narrative arc, and then turn that into some sort of manifestation of the story. Usually it's a comic book.
So you call up science fiction writers and say, we've got some data.
Yeah.
And we want you to make some stories out of it.
Yeah.
They just have to be set here in Lowe's.
No. So only direction we ever give them is that it's got to be the time frame, so 10 years in the future, and then the location, the primary location of the story. So 10 years from now in Cincinnati.
Can I try finding something?
Sure can.
Hello.
Hey, little buddy.
Wait, it turned away from you. It's running away from you, John.
You know, it happens all the time.
Tell me by pressing the speak button or typing below.
Can I get some D batteries, 12 of them?
Please select an item below.
Oh, it stopped working.
Oh, what's it say?
It's having a Windows problem. The Lobot is new around here, they say. It's in beta. It still has a bunch of bugs to be worked out. It wasn't terribly helpful at helping Quina or me find the items we were looking for.
The robot does a lot of like little things. If you're coming in for a very specific thing, it can show you exactly where it is. But natural language processing is still in its infancy and all these things. But once again, because we're trying, we see the future where these things are going, we have to figure out how they integrate in. And that means working with it when it's not exactly perfect and dealing with Wi-Fi issues and other things.
Thinking in the back of the future kind of way. In 10 years, what do you think the ratio is going to be between robots and employees, human employees, I guess?
So I think a good way to think about it is we've had smartphones like in its kind of state for a little over 10 years now. And, you know, we all carry around the supercomputers in our pockets, and it doesn't make any of us obsolete. It just gives us superpowers. That's honestly and truly what the intent of these robots are. And I see a lot of these robots, both visual and those that you can't see that are going in the background, AI and other things, just give us more intuitive superpowers that just make us and augment us and make us better, both the store associates and our customers too. So I actually think that you'll see more robots in real life, but actually a lot of the robotics will happen in the background and you won't see it as much.
Okay. So I have to say, John, I'm not too worried about these guys taking my job.
Yeah, exactly.
So who's worried about their job? The Lobot hasn't stolen anyone's job yet, but automation and technology have always had the effect of replacing humans.
The U.S. has lost 5 million manufacturing jobs since 2000. A 2015 report from Ball State University calculated that 88% of those jobs were eaten up by automation, not workers from other countries. And a new report from PwC estimates that 40% of jobs in the U.S. are vulnerable to automation. Quina, are they talking about us? I mean, should two working journalists, smart people like us, be worried?
Well, I don't know how smart I am, but I hope I'm not going to be worried. But I know the guy who can answer this question for us. His name is Eric Hanushek. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University, which is just down the freeway from here. And he studies things like the future of the labor market. I asked Professor Hanushek, should I be worried? And if not, who should be worried?
You're probably pretty safe, and you'll probably make it. But a lot of other people should be worried, because people that are doing rather routine jobs that used to provide a good middle-class, upper-middle-class income are going away. And that's something that we have to adapt to.
So just to try to get an example here, is there an artificial intelligence replacement for the local financial advisor down the street?
We're already selling those services. They exist. I mean, there are still some people that are providing that person to person, but there are also companies that are selling, in fact.
And it's possible that a lot of the person to person people are using the software and just sort of being your friend.
Absolutely. It's like doing tax returns where somebody sits there across the table from you, but they're really using the same program that you and I use. And it's not that all jobs are going to go away. It's just the character of jobs is going to be radically different.
We've gone through these big shifts before, and I'm sort of thinking of when we used to be a more agriculture-based economy and we shifted to a more industrial one. How do we go through that shift, and are those lessons relevant still today?
Well, some of the lessons are relevant, but not exactly the agricultural shift or the shift to manufacturing even. What's relevant is that today the premium is on skills. It's not on the quality of the land or the organization of the production process. It's on the skills that people have and their ability to adapt to a very different world.
So I heard something. You're talking about retraining, and I wanted to run this by you. I was talking to some folks who are in this field, and they were saying that you can't retrain people enough. Once you start retraining people to work on machine A, machine B comes along in 10 years, and then you got to retrain them. And it's almost happening too quickly for this retraining concept to take hold right now.
I think that's what we've seen, is that the advances in some production or in the service industry have been more rapid in recent years, pushed by a lot of technology and computerization and so forth, and that has made it very difficult for many people to keep up.
Well, but Quina makes this outrageously important point, and that is, you know, 10 years ago, everyone's talking about you have to learn to code, that if you don't know how to code, you don't have a fluency that is going to be absolutely essential for the 21st century. Now they're talking about robots coding. They're talking about software devices that can code, and that coding is not important, And it seems to be a whole generation, or at least a whole 10 to 15 years of community college education has gone down the tubes.
Well, that's one of the problems we have. Some people want to predict what next year's jobs are going to be like or 10 years from now. And I keep forgetting the exact numbers, but like half of the job titles today didn't exist 10 years ago. And so it's very hard to predict specific skills. What we need are people that have generalized skills that can adapt, that can move into different kinds of jobs, and they can adjust to these kinds of jobs.
Well, I'm curious then, what industries or companies do you see doing that well, either here in the United States or abroad?
Well, if you're sitting in the middle of Silicon Valley, you are amazed by what is going on here of people with new ideas, with new ways of doing things.
But I think there's a conversation here in Silicon Valley that we are really importing a lot of that talent from abroad, and our American workers are being left out. They're not being trained, and they don't have these skills. So I guess in that sense, I'm sort of curious. It doesn't really seem like the Silicon Valley companies are stepping up in terms of creating a new American workforce. But are they?
You're making a very good point. I was stunned to learn recently that if you look at all the STEM PhDs, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, all the STEM PhDs in the U.S., 55% were foreign-born. Now, that number just blew me away. And I think it reflects the fact that other countries are having a better education system than ours. And that's where we have to compete. In the future, we have to compete with a highly educated, highly trained workforce that can, in fact, move into these different areas. Now, in the short run, we're getting great advantages as a nation from being able to rent these PhDs from abroad. They come here and they come to Stanford for their PhD programs and they stay. And that's a good thing. And that's not something that we should stop. But in the longer run, we're in trouble if we have to rely on that and we don't produce our own highly trained workforce.
How hopeful are you that we are going to start attacking these problems as a country with everything that's happening in Washington? Do you see some sort of big education rollout in the horizon? Are you seeing these issues that you're raising being addressed?
Well, I'm the eternal optimist about how things will work out. But I don't think it's Washington, frankly. Everybody focuses on Washington, but it's the individual states. The states control education, and whether they step up or not is an open question. I think we're going to see some states really doing interesting things and other states stuck. And frankly, one of the concerns I have is California looks pretty stuck right now and is not the exciting place for the education of the future.
Well, Eric Hanushek, professor at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, thanks very much for coming on to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So how worried are you that automation will make your job obsolete?
I am Larry Bush from Tampa, Florida. I'm a college history instructor who researches political cartoons. I will be long dead before computers can decipher the rhetoric of political humor. So I think my job is pretty safe.
This is Jermaine from Tampa. Part of my job is reviewing medical records to determine whether a treatment plan meets appropriate use. While a computer might be able to say that the treatment plan didn't meet guidelines or standards, it cannot judge whether there were extenuating circumstances that perhaps made the order appropriate. That's my job.
Share your worries with us. We're here to help. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Queenie Kim from KQED.
Our takeaway journey continues into the very many new workplaces you can find around here in the Bay Area.
For instance, John, Amazon. Do you want to see what goes on after you click and make your purchase?
Sure.
Well, I drove out to Tracy, which is a town east of here, where there's a huge warehouse nearby a bunch of freeways. The first thing you notice upon entering the Amazon Fulfillment Center is it's really loud.
It's the conveyance.
That's Ashley Robinson. She's an Amazon spokesperson. And what she's saying is that noise, it's the conveyance, or what most people call conveyor belts.
We've got miles of conveyance here in this facility.
Right then, in front of us, I could see three stories of conveyor belts. On them, yellow plastic boxes holding customer orders whiz by.
And they're heading towards the pack stations, where they'll be packed with the label applied and sent out to the loading dock.
The second thing you notice about the fulfillment center is it's huge.
This facility is over 1 million square feet, which equals to about 28 football fields.
There are four stories in this warehouse, and the job of moving things from the inventory that comes in to the orders that go out is clearly the domain of automation. But what sets Amazon apart from its competitors is on the fourth floor behind a black chain link fence.
So these are the Amazon robots. They're orange square shaped drive units.
The robots are about 3 feet wide and 1 foot tall. And in the cage with them, hundreds, maybe thousands of shelves. The shelves are about 6 feet tall and stacked with a random assortment of products, from dog biscuits to vitamins to books and toys. The robot slides underneath a shelf and picks it up and carries it to a human worker called pickers, who stand on the other side of the chain link fence. When the shelf arrives, the picker looks up at a computer screen to see what a customer has ordered. The item might be right in front of her, or she might have to move that toy out of the way and reach into the back of the shelf to find it. Once she picks the item off the shelf, she scans it and the robot takes the shelf away. The picker then puts the item into a yellow box and off it goes on the conveyor belt. And off it goes on the conveyor belt. And up comes another robot with its shelf full of stuff.
So in a traditional fulfillment center where the associate would walk to the different items within a library of inventory, it can take hours to fulfill a customer order. With the robotics, it can take minutes.
As we've been hearing in the show, we are already living in a world where humans and machines are working side by side. From the little Lobot helper to the cutting-edge Amazon robots we just heard about. And as this trend gets more and more pronounced, what's this going to mean in terms of the peaceful coexistence between man and machine? Michael Chewy researches these kind of trends for McKinsey & Company. We sat down with him in his office in downtown San Francisco.
When we looked at 2,000 different activities that we pay people to do in the economy, three types of activities came to the fore as being more automatable. Now, some of them are physical activities within predictable environments, and those are the kinds of things you do find in distribution centers, in assembly lines, etc. But two other categories, which again we did find to have a lot of potential for automation by adapting technologies we have today, one is collecting data and the other is analyzing data.
So what we saw with the first one you're talking about, manufacturing, you're saying it's automated because the idea is that these are very rote tasks. Is that the notion?
Yeah, again, the physical activities, which don't require as much flexibility. So you might describe them as rote. You might describe them as predictable. Those are the types of activities which, from a technical standpoint, appear to be easiest to automate.
So tell us why the pickers. Do you think they're going to be automated anytime soon?
At least currently, there are some tasks which are more difficult to automate, even though they're in predictable physical environments, and for a couple of reasons. One is that they might require some sensory capability, which machines, we believe, at some point will get there, but right now, humans are able to do it better. The other factor involved, though, and in addition to the technical factors, is what actually is more economical. And while from a pure technical standpoint, it might be possible for picking and packing to be done by machines. In some cases, it would actually be less expensive for a person to do it. So that entire business case is another reason or another factor which influences the pace and extent of automation.
Yeah, and with the picking, I was thinking about with that task, it's very much all the shapes are different. You don't really know. Like, it's not that the box is going to be on the third rung every single time, right? It takes a human to discern that. Can you sort of flesh that out a little bit, why those tasks are difficult for
computers to do.
And so this comes down to this idea of the difference between predictable and unpredictable physical activities. You know, the human hand is amazing, right? I mean, we can certainly create robots that are stronger than a human hand, that are smaller than a human hand, but that combination of sensory capabilities as well as movement and that entire combination, along with our ability to look with our eyes, that, you know, all of those things put together, while theoretically someday will be, you know, automatable, currently, people actually do many of these tasks a little better and in some cases less expensive.
Then the second part of that was saying, you were saying big data basically is another area that's going to be automated.
There's a lot of work that is just simply collecting data into one place and then further using that data, analyzing that data.
What are some of those? I've heard of the computer that can read x-rays.
Yeah, I mean, the healthcare industry is incredibly interesting because if you go into a healthcare setting, we often think about the things that are, in quotes, most valuable, or the people who are paid most within a healthcare setting as being doctors, because they do differential diagnosis, they collect information, they process it in order to determine a diagnosis and then determine a prescription or a therapy to try to, you know, make the sick well. But what we're finding in a surprising way is sometimes, you know, that brain on a stick activity, that activity just collecting information and analyzing it in order to determine, you know, what the diagnosis is and how to do what therapy to prescribe, might be some of the things that are easiest to automate within a healthcare provider setting.
Michael Chui, partner at the McKinsey Global Institute, thanks so much for coming on to The Takeaway.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, helping small business owners get started with incorporation, LLCs, DBAs, and nonprofits, while providing ongoing legal advice through its network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Queenie Kim, along with John Hockenberry today. Until now, we've been talking about how the market will decide what jobs will disappear due to automation. Now, let's think about how through economic policies, legislation, and through public sector choices, what can be done to cushion the fall.
For more than a century, economists have contemplated what would happen if all citizens were offered a guaranteed basic income, regular, unconditional cash payment, not like welfare or unemployment insurance. If you're a citizen, you get it.
Now, this isn't a newfangled theory. Martin Luther King Jr. actually made it part of the public debate back in the 1960s.
That is a great deal that the society can and must do if the Negro is to gain the economic security that he needs. Now, one of the answers, it seems to me, is a guaranteed annual income, a guaranteed minimum income for all people and for all families of our country.
Natalie Foster is someone who today believes in what's called the universal basic income. She's a co-chair of the Economic Security Project, and I spoke to her in her house in Oakland, where she told me that the UBI has attracted both liberals and conservatives.
In American history in the 60s, we saw people like Milton Friedman, a conservative economist, introducing the term the negative income tax. This being the idea that if you make below a certain amount, that you receive money from the government to get you up to that level of income that is considered viable. If you make above it, then you don't. But in the 70s, you saw some really interesting politics come to play in this, where Nixon was elected by a very narrow margin. The Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, and he had Senator Patrick Moynihan create for him a plan that he ended up calling the Family Assistance Plan, which basically was a negative income tax. It would have given money to families directly. It would have reduced poverty by 60%. But in the end, it was the Democrats who decided it didn't actually go far enough, and so it was shelved. And then in the 70s, you had a Republican governor in Alaska who created the Sovereign Wealth Fund, taking the oil royalties, the money earned from oil drilling in Alaska, and putting it into a fund that the entire state owned and that every resident of Alaska would receive the dividends of each year. And what's interesting is that's money that they didn't work for or earn in the traditional sense, and they don't see it as a handout.
Who's going to pay for this? That's a million-dollar question, right? Or maybe the trillion-dollar question. I don't really know.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different ideas of how one could pay for a universal basic income. You know, there's one set of ideas that says, like Alaska, why don't we put a price on the things that we commonly own that we currently give away for free? So the idea of putting a price on carbon. There's the idea of a small fee on high-frequency trading, known as the financial transaction tax, that would capture some of the value that happens, you know, daily and is currently just goes to, you know, a very small number of people.
In your mind, does everybody get a universal basic income from the millionaire to the house cleaner?
Well, so the classic idea of a universal basic income is that it would go to everyone. And the theory being a universal program just has more political popularity than something that just goes to the poor. You know, I think an example of this is Social Security, where you have a program that does not go to just the poor or the middle class, but it goes to everyone, you know, presumably who works in the United States and contributed in. And it is immensely popular. And so I think that there is something there. At the same time, I think negative income tax ideas or guaranteed minimum income, which ensures you don't live in poverty, is also a really interesting idea and may be more politically viable in the near term.
That's Natalie Foster, co-chair of the Economic Security Project.
As you might expect, some countries are ahead of us in this approach to unemployment and poverty. Three guesses? Well, entire villages in Kenya have been receiving a basic income through a charity program. There's a small pilot program in the Netherlands. India is considering it. Of course, Canada has a pilot going in several cities in Ontario starting this summer.
But Finland may be the farthest along. They launched a basic income experiment this January where 2,000 unemployed people between the ages of 25 and 58 each receive $600 a month unconditionally for 2 years.
Kela, Finland's Social Security Institution, is running this pilot. Marjukka Turunen is director of change management for Kela, where she's in charge of executing the program.
The main goal is to see if this kind of basic income mechanism in social security system will tackle the problem. Of course, this $600 is not that big of a money, and of course, they won't survive with that the whole month, depending on whether they have children or not. But the idea is that they can be sure of this $600 per month, that they will get it at the same date every month, so they can be sure of that. We don't care how will they spend this money. So one guy said that he will now have enough money that he will have food on the table for his children. But if somebody wants to, you know, buy some vodka and stay home, that's not our business to tell that that's a wrong way to use the money. Of course, we don't know how people will use the money if they have unemployment benefits. So that's the same system in this basic income also.
Does this basic income supplement other benefits from Social Security?
Yes, it replaces unemployment benefit, basic unemployment benefit, and the sickness benefits and parental benefits in this experiment. So we want to see if this kind of mechanism reduces the bureaucracy there also when people's status changes. So they get a baby or they go and study or whatever, they don't have to apply for another benefit. They stay in this experiment. But mainly it replaces basic unemployment benefit.
How did you come up with the $600 a month?
It's the amount of the basic unemployment benefit with no increasement. So if you are single and living alone, so you will get this approximately 560 euros, so $600. If we would give people $1,500, it would be no incentive at all to go and seek for jobs for many people because you can easily survive with that here in Finland. And so we tried to figure out the amount that would be accurate and would be enough for these people to seek for jobs but not passivate themselves for staying at home and just not doing anything. But the idea here is to give these people this financial security that they can free their minds, not worrying all the time about the money, the basic needs. They can now fulfill them with this basic income because the problem in our unemployment benefit system that it's not worthwhile for you to take on, for example, a part-time job sometimes because we have incentive traps in our social security system that sometimes when you take on part-time job, you will get less money into your hand than when you would be in full unemployment benefit. So there is this idea that it's now worthwhile with this basic income to take on part-time jobs because you get the earnings, you get the paychecks, and it does not reduce this basic income.
Can we talk about feelings a little bit? You mentioned that the Social Security system is pretty bureaucratic. I suspect that means people have to stand in line and devote an entire day or a chunk of their day to dealing with paperwork. Is just getting an income simply like that, does it increase the respect that people have, their sense of confidence, and that you know, erases the stigma from being unemployed?
Yeah. Yes, actually, many of them have been saying that their stress level is really down because you never know when you get the money and how much will you get. And that's the insecurity feeling that you always have in your life when you're taking and doing the part-time jobs. There was this one woman who said that I was afraid every time that phone rings that unemployment services are calling to offering me a job. She said that she cannot take on jobs because she's taking care of her elderly parents at home. So this experiment really has an indirect impact also to, I think, to the stress levels and mental health and so on.
Is a basic income an update for the social security system around the world? They're trying it in Finland. We've been speaking with Marjukka Turunen, who's head of the legal affairs unit for Kela, Finland's social security institution. Marjukka, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Marjukka Turunen. She and her colleagues in Finland will assess whether this program is a success or failure at the end of 2018.
Where's the money? Where's the money?
Money talks.
Everybody needs money. That's why they call it money.
Isn't this guy supposed to be a millionaire?
Just follow the money.
I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm Queenie Kim from KQED in San Francisco.
So we could probably agree that everyone loves the idea of the government giving all of us free money, right?
Yeah, who doesn't like free money?
But the mission for us is to figure out who exactly could benefit most from a guaranteed annual income, a universal wage. And you found some folks.
Yeah, and I guess what I was interested in was because a lot of people were saying, well, if you just give people money, are they going to work? Aren't they just going to slack off? And I thought I'd just sort of take this question to people who are working right now.
It plays into all of our sort of myths about people on welfare and people are lazy if they take money. This would really force us to think very, very differently about what we think of government assistance.
Exactly. And it really does sort of break down into, and I hate to use this word, but sort of the elites, people who are gainfully employed in sort of the knowledge economy, who often ask these questions. What would people do if we gave them free money? Would they work? And people who are sort of working low-skill jobs, they don't hesitate to answer this question. It's sort of like a no-brainer to them. It's not even a question they ask. What would I do with this money? So I spoke to Christina Scardino. We met at a Starbucks in Fremont. She's a bakery clerk at Winco Supermarket. She works almost 40 hours a week at Winco, but then to make ends meet, she works, you know, doing these gig jobs. She used to work at the Numi plant. It's a car factory that's in Fremont, where she made about $30 an hour. She makes around $12 an hour now, so it's quite a pay cut. And she's had to move into her parents' home. And this is her story.
I worked at Numi for 21 years. Basically, I grew up there. And when the plant shut down, everything just went downhill after that. My health went down. I've had 2 surgeries. I had tumors in my uterus. I had to take my gallbladder out. And then I had property and I had to sell it.
You had a home?
Yes.
So you had to sell your home to pay for your medical costs?
Yeah, I did that too as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now you're living with your folks?
Yes. Yeah.
How did that happen?
I had all these medical bills and I'm making like $10 an hour and I'm barely making ends meet. So right now Silicon Valley is very expensive. I mean, rent here is like $1,600, $2,000 or $3,000. It's just crazy over here.
If you were to get a certain income, I don't know, like $500 a month from the government, how would you use that money?
I would put it onto my medical bills.
How much do you owe?
Over $40,000, but now I owe like around $20,000.
So here's this hearing impaired woman mm-hmm. who's going to have a serious uphill battle getting a job that mm-hmm. would match her manufacturing job that she had. And she's going to use the guaranteed annual income to pay her medical bills. So here you see how the income program would solve a healthcare problem at the same time.
Exactly.
So who else have we met here?
J. Marie Hill, musician and community organizer.
And how would J. Marie Hill use a guaranteed annual income?
Let's have J. Marie tell us.
Well, I would give some to a lot of my folks who are trans and need like help with their like surgeries and just really basic health care for my friends who are often like also organizers, musicians, artists, a very undervalued, you know, job and a creative product that they produce. And I would just probably save some of it too to try and have a little foundation when something goes wrong. But yeah, I would give a lot of it away probably and just try and make the most of it in the short term but also long term.
And I'm struck that J. Murray Hill has really thought this through as a change that we would all have in the way we think about what's in our pockets.
I think that it would actually create a much more fluid and open conversation around money. So then, honestly, the people that like historically have not had access to the things that they need would still be those people. They just because we all have, you know, UBI doesn't mean that it kind of wipes away historical injustices and lack of access to the things that people need that is historically anti-black, historically anti-trans, anti-queer, all these things. So I think while we may be able to talk about it more fluidly and clearly and kind of out loud, I think there would be ways that, yeah, I would still, just like I do now, like try and pool my money with my friends and make sure that we invest in things that we all care about and need.
It used to be guaranteed annual income when I was in school, but what's UBI?
UBI is universal basic income, which is what we've been talking about.
Did J. Murray Hill respond to the question of whether this UBI, this basic income, would actually replace work?
Yeah, and the idea is no, not really. You know, whatever the UBI would be, I don't think anybody would think that it would be enough to replace work here in the Bay Area where the cost of living is so high. So I think it's really thought of as supplemental income.
Do you think you'd stop working?
Nope, definitely not. I think it's just to help you have a little buffer and gives you more of a space to actually kind of pursue the things that really make your heart happy instead of having to work, put your nose to the grind just to, you know, eat and survive.
Padding to keep people from having to just survive. That's the idea here.
Right, and that's a recurring theme.
So think about it now. Is your job worth more to you than just a paycheck?
Hi, this is Jack from Council Bluffs, Iowa. My job is my paycheck right now. I'm 58 and can't retire, so I have to work until I drop or until I'm no longer able to work, whichever comes first. My, quote, sense of self, end quote, is pretty beat up right now, so maybe guaranteed income wouldn't make much of any difference one way or the other.
Hi, I'm Judy King from San Anselmo, California, and I'm a public high school math teacher, and my job is worth far more than my paycheck. My job is very challenging, very rewarding, and feeds my soul. I would have difficulty finding another job or volunteer activity that gives me so many daily opportunities to try and make a difference.
Hi, this is Chris Sumption from Seattle, Washington. I'm both a freelance dramaturg and an adjunct instructor at an arts college. Neither of those jobs pays well, and neither is secure. But the work itself is deeply satisfying. So if I lost my job, but I had a guaranteed monthly income, I'd still do much of what I do now. I just wouldn't worry so much about being able to pay my mortgage.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us. We're at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo, offering print products with features like Printfinity, a technology that gives the ability to print a different image on every business card. Learn more at Moo.com. What's a man supposed to do when
he's down and out of work? So nearly at the end of this hour, we can all agree that people can't count on having the same kind of jobs they have today. Can our society handle something like that?
I don't know, but I'm waiting for the Lobot to come back. How do you value work? That's really the question.
Hello, this is Aaron from Michigan, and I feel that a guaranteed income that I didn't earn would make me feel like a burden. My job isn't that important, but it provides for myself and my family and helped me prepare for retirement. There is no value to what you don't earn.
Hi, my name is Dorothy, and for me, I value my sense of self way more than a paycheck, and I'd rather get paid less doing the job that I love than get paid more and have my overall health at risk. And I say that from personal experience.
As you can hear, work goes beyond money.
So a universal basic income would only recoup part of the value of any job. The rest is intangible. It's cultural. It's based on expectations which differ. For instance, expectations for men or for women.
Joanna Reed is a sociologist and lecturer at the University of California, Berkeley, where she studies the sociological impact of work.
In the United States, I think in particular, and this is something that would vary a lot from place to place, but I think
we could argue strongly that work is viewed as a sort of a virtue as well as something of that people need to do for economic reasons to provide for themselves and their families. So thinking of it from that standpoint, I mean, people get a lot of other things besides income from work. They might get a sense of identity, a sense of meaning as a worker themselves or from a specific job they have. They gain status from work through the kind of job they have, but also through the money they earn, which allows us to buy things and compete for status in our materialistic society. So I think those are some of the other intangible factors around not having work.
What are the sociological dimensions of the changes in the workplace that you've studied?
Well, there's certainly the dimension of what's going to happen to the individuals, right? I mean, I think if we look back at historical shifts around the labor market and what kinds of jobs are available and who's working at those jobs, we see a variety of responses. And some are abrupt shifts, like the Great Depression, or there's a war. Others are maybe more slow-moving shifts, like the shift away from an industrial economy after World War II into a service-based economy. Things like the large-scale movement of women into the labor force over, you know, since the 1970s on, that we've seen responses to that based kind of public and private responses, so public ones through political action. In the government, legislative responses, as well as collective action, thinking of labor activism, other grassroots sort of organizing around different shifts that have happened. And then we see private families, people sort of figuring out how to make sense of the new reality. So families have been described in the words of one sociologist as shock absorbers for what happens sort of with the economy more broadly, and that it's at home that these change. If somebody loses a job, say, or loses a means of economic support in other ways, that's the family that has to come to terms with how to deal with that on a day-to-day basis.
So I guess we're seeing signs of this sort of shrinking labor force changing sort of the makeup of the family and how we think of family.
It could be, yeah. Certainly, yeah. I mean, we've seen that young people, compared to people my age, who I'm 41, so are more likely to move back in with their parents after college, for example. And we see that trend reflected in the data of more multi-generational households over time. That also keeping in mind, you know, demographic shifts in that in the United States population, and that those traditions of extended family living are stronger among some people from different cultural backgrounds than others. But traditionally in the U.S., extended family living has not been emphasized. The nuclear family model was emphasized, especially after the World War II period, the idea of two parents, their own kids living on their own in their own home, rather than any kind of extended family model. So certainly that could be an outcome. And it also fits very well into this do-it-yourself ethic of solving labor market disruptions, I think, that's emphasized at least culturally in the U.S.
As a sociologist, mm-hmm. Do you see a limit to the number of people who can exist comfortably in a society where there aren't enough available jobs, that basically a shortened workforce, a smaller workforce, can possibly sustain everybody, but that sociologically, people without jobs, that's going to have real downsides, even if they're not poor, per se. You can't really function without a job in the United States without losing some of your identity.
Well, I think we should think about cultural expectations for different social categories of people around work, and we don't have the same ones for everybody. And so I think the consequences of not having a job and not having an identity that was centered around work is different for different groups of people. So some examples to sort of tell you what I'm thinking about here. Gender is a really important category for work. Work is so, as sociologists would say, gendered in so many ways in terms of this thinking about, do men and women even have the same types of jobs? There's a lot of gender segregation still in terms of the types of jobs people have. But thinking about, especially for men in the United States, especially fathers, and the role of breadwinning and the cultural imperative on men to still be breadwinners. We could think that for them, not having a job might be different than for, say, the mother of a newborn, where there's still some, not a real consensus even all the time about if she should be working or not. Mothers of young children report that they can feel judged, negatively, whether they go back to work right away or if they don't and they opt to, maybe spend more time with a new baby at home. So also thinking about age and our expectations around age for people that work, if a person loses a job when they're 65 versus a, 35-year-old person losing a job. I guess the answer to your original question would be that it wouldn't be the same for everybody. And that some people would probably struggle more than others. And also about 3/4, I believe, of Americans say they would continue to work even if they had enough money to financially support themselves for the rest of their lives. So then that speaks to this idea that people get a lot more than just money from work.
Joanna Reed is a sociologist and lecturer at the University of California, Berkeley, where she studies the sociological impact of work.
So the final thing here at the end of this hour, we bring back our pal, the Lobot, with the age-old question in American retail.
Can I help you find something?
You're laughing now, John Hockenberry, but journalists are on that list of professions that are most vulnerable to automation.
Oh, yeah. So robots are going to start saying analytical things like Americans are dealing with a
crisis of truth and authority. Who has credibility? Who has power? And can the American government make good on its responsibilities?
I don't know, John. I mean, you have a nice voice, but that machine sounds pretty good, too.
And the voice is only getting better.
It can handle any repetitive task.
Like how I say, call us at 877-8MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
Call us at 877-8MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
Ha! Maybe we're not so expendable after all. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks so much for listening.
Stop that. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Queena Kim from KQED in San Francisco.
Thanks for doing this, Queena.
Well, let's do it again. And this is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com and by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Can I help you find something?